So, how long we got? Where's our destination today?
I don't know. We got 20 miles to cover. Let's talk some movies. People don't know how to drive.
Are we going to get lunch on this gig? You see anything good recently?
Not really. Right, we got a little time, Steve. Let's do a podcast.
Sounds good. Hey, welcome back. It's been a while. This is Film Driven. I'm Steve Haskins.
I'm Andre Shane. Yeah, we're back driving around in this new year. Happy New Year, Steve.
Happy New Year.
Thank you very much. And, of course, this new year was particularly packed with cinematic morsels for our enjoyment, and we'll talk about a couple of them today.
Yeah, we're going to focus just on two movies today. Two movies that are current in theaters right now, getting both buzz and money. And these movies, not only, you know, we're going to straight up review them in a way, but we'll also discuss, both these movies have unique viewing experiences.
That's very true.
It's very a large part of it. And the two films are, yeah, Star Wars The Force Awakens and The Hateful Eight.
The Hateful Eight. That's right. And, you know, there's a word that's been sort of going around for the past few years, and that's called an event film. It's like a new catchphrase, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm not sure when that started, Steve. When did the event, when did they start calling them event films? It's like, is it when the Star Wars prequels came out and people were like, oh my God, it's not just a movie, it's an event?
Well, I don't know, because at first I thought that term was more or less a synonym for the word blockbuster.
Mm-hmm.
Or another one, and especially in the summer, they call them tentpole pictures.
Right.
Like, you know, a movie that's supposed to be, will generate so much money that then, you know, it'll help keep the rest of the studio afloat.
Right.
Part of the theory is that, you know, if you make the Avengers Age of Ultron, then you got a little money left over to make a $40 million drama for fall release.
Right. Well, that certainly applies to the Star Wars film. I'm not sure if it how it applies to The Hateful Eight, but we'll talk about The Hateful Eight. But we'll start with Star Wars.
Let's start with Star Wars. Yeah, we know.
The Force Awakens, Steve.
Exactly.
It awakens.
It
was asleep. It was taking a nap, and now it clearly awoke.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yes. How did you like The Force Awakens?
I really liked it. I thought I had a great time. You know, I've got some quibbles. I don't think it's a perfect film. You know, I mean, what is a perfect film? The Incredibles, we said, is close.
Well,
but,
yeah, it's pretty flat. Maybe
that said, in terms of what this movie was supposed to do, which is, I mean, let's be frank, there was a lot asked of this movie.
Sure.
The responsibility of J.J. Abrams and his team and the screenwriter and everybody's like, okay, here's all you need to do. You need to make a movie that's entertaining, well-liked, that won't let down crazy obsessive people who've had dreams about this franchise for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
As well as, you know, make sure you don't just throw the whole thing in the toilet going forward.
That's true.
Also redeem the sins of the prequels.
Yeah, the George Lucas prequels
that
everybody seems to hate.
Yeah, that's
maybe
a lot
fairly
of
or unfairly.
Responsibility. And I have to say that, I mean, it's more or less a slam dunk. I think he did it. Like, it delivered on almost everything it was supposed to do.
Yeah, mission accomplished to a large degree. I mean, first of all, the movie is making unbelievable money. I mean, it's sort of slated to surpass Avatar. It already blew past Titanic as one of the most successful films of all time.
Yeah.
So only Avatar is left to go. So somewhere, James Cameron is weeping. perhaps, or whatever it is he's doing. He's probably very competitive and unhappy. The film is seems to be really succeeding, and people seem to like it. Although there are certainly naysayers, Steve.
There are, but even the naysayers are, I mean, I don't know, speaking personally, the only people I know who seem to hate it are people who just don't, I mean, they don't like Star Wars or movies like this in general.
Yeah, and I saw it with my friend who does not like Star Wars, and he hated this film. And you know, when we were talking about it afterwards, I just told him to shut the hell up. Because it's like his opinion is meaningless. Like, I mean, like, if I don't like polka music, I mean, I'm not going to give a positive review to the Polka's Greatest Hits album. It's not going to happen. So,
yeah, like, you'll meet somebody who's like, I don't like populist sci-fi with weird aliens. Well,
yeah.
You're, well... Yeah, you're going to... This movie doesn't redeem the genre for you.
Well, no, no. And of course, I've always said that Star Wars is not really sci-fi, honestly. I mean, it's sort of fantasy. To me, it's closer to Lord of the Rings than it is to, you know, do androids dream of electric sheep or something
like
that.
Sure, there's not a lot of actual science.
No.
It's an adventure tale that takes place outside of Earth.
Yeah, it's a fantasy set in a space kind of futuristic setting, although it takes place a long time ago, obviously, in a galaxy far, far away.
Far, far away.
But, you know, but it's got wizards and knights and that kind of, and princesses. I mean, it really is, you know, it really is, owes a lot more to Tolkien than it does to Jules Verne.
Sure.
But having said that, you know, the J.J. Abrams film, getting back to what he had to accomplish, I think the biggest challenge, besides all of those things that you mentioned, Steve, was the fact that this movie took Star Wars in completely uncharted territory. You know what I'm saying? This is a brand new story. Yes, it uses older characters and uses them very effectively, I might say. But really, the territory is new. The plot moves into the future, unlike the Lucas prequels that essentially set out to tell the story of Anakin Skywalker and how he turns into the evil Darth Vader. This is not like that. This really creates completely new characters, resets the whole thing for the next generation, and it's difficult to do. It's a very complicated equation that J.J. Abrams had to deal with, and he really kind of kicked ass on it, I thought.
So yeah, let's talk about some stuff that worked and some things that didn't for us. And just for anybody who's wondering, both for this and The Hateful Eight, I mean, we're going to spoil everything. So if you haven't seen the movie,
Yoda lives!
Come back to us.
Just kidding.
But yeah, let's start off talking about some of those old characters they had to incorporate. Like, you know, we all knew going into this that Harrison Ford, Mark Hamill, and Carrie Fisher were all going to appear in some capacity.
Right.
You know, they kept it all tight-lipped. We
also
didn't know what was going
on. Also, the droids. Don't forget C-3PO.
You know, I don't know if I read a lot about that, but I just kind of assumed. I mean, R2-D2 and C-3PO seem to be fairly immortal at this point.
Well, they are droids.
Yeah. And Chewbacca, of course.
And they are back. Chewie, of course.
So we have those guys. They came back. Harrison Ford, I thought, gave his most entertaining performance in maybe decades, and a lot more Harrison Ford than I thought I was going to get.
Yeah, very, very true. When the film started shooting, there was instantly all of these things, all of these rumors that started emerging from the set. Like, it was difficult to gauge how involved Harrison Ford was going to be.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of times, like, movies that Harrison Ford stars in, he's not, doesn't seem to be that involved in, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But it was hard to tell with this because, you know, for years, Harrison Ford really kind of badmouthed Star Wars and literally went on record to say he will never return to the role of Han Solo. So when he did come back to do this movie, there was all of this speculation of how major is the role going to be in the film, and it was pretty damn major, Steve.
Yeah.
But the thing is, one of the rumors that came from the set is Harrison Ford was seriously injured on set, like
broke his leg or something.
Yeah, but I mean, it was very early in the process of his, you know, of his role. Like on day three on the set, he Millennium Falcon fell on him and crushed his leg. Major injury, by the way, for elderly gentleman.
Yeah,
Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
So there were all these rumors that now his part is going to be even smaller because he just wasn't physically able to film because of the injury. And it really didn't seem that way. I mean, he is large and in charge, man. He is, you know, he's arguably got the biggest part of the movie. Though he's not the main character, but I mean,
well, he's certainly the source of a lot of the emotional continuation of or the Han Solo story.
Right.
You know, I grew up with Star Wars. When I was a kid, those are my favorite movies. It's funny, I meet people who, the only people who think I'm obsessed with Star Wars are people who, like, never watch them.
Who hate Star Wars, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, like, they're like, oh my god, you're obsessed, and it's like, I'm not. I mean, like, I grew older, I became more of an adult, you know, like, but that said, the part that I think would have broken my childhood heart would have been just a horrible Han Solo performance.
Yeah.
That if Harrison Ford came in and sleepwalked with a smirk on his face through like two cameo scenes.
Yeah.
That would have bummed me out.
That would have been,
you know, like it just would have been depressing.
Which is what I actually thought of R2-D2's performance, in all honesty.
He really did. He nailed it in.
Yeah, he nailed it in a little bit. But okay, we'll continue.
But no, Harrison Ford was, it was a legit, it was great. He was great. I mean, I don't know what much more to say about than that.
Well, he was great, and it was, and Chewbacca was great, and his interaction with, you know, to their interaction, they were almost like a comedy team in this movie.
Yeah.
Almost more so than all the other Star Wars movies. So on that level, it's very satisfying. You know, I love Chewbacca. He was fantastic, and it was, you know, Leia was in it as well, and you know, her problem is that she just hasn't really been an active actor for a long time. So I think with her, they really needed to kind of figure out where she would be comfortable in her ability to deliver a role. You know, they didn't want her to come off like Karen Allen did in the Indiana Jones sequel, you know, where she literally seemed like an amateur, like she'd forgotten how to be in front of the camera. And I thought they handled her rather well, too, to be honest with you. I actually was, you know, I was surprised by how affecting her on-screen presence was to me personally. I don't know why. I never really had a, you know, like she was never my favorite Star Wars character or anything like that. But she was really good in the film, and I liked how they used her, you know, and I liked the moments she had with Harrison Ford, even though I think they actually should have had a little bit more of moments, you know.
Yeah.
I thought that was, that may be one of my qualms about it, is that I thought it was a little bit shortchanged on their relationship. It seemed like there could have been a lot more to be said there, but
I disagree a little bit, if only, well, I had two problems with it. I mean, one, there is a scene where Princess Leia and Han Solo are discussing their, you know, the dissolution of their relationship. And to me, the dialogue in that scene was a little too just on the nose.
Well,
you know,
that
again, this is one of my quibbles with the film was, you know, there's certain, a lot of it I thought really worked well. That scene in particular just bugged me because it was just a bit like each character just bluntly stating their emotion, you know,
right,
like
right.
Nothing hidden under even the smallest, you know, it's like, when we broke up, I went back to the only thing I was ever good at. I mean, I'm like, all right, you know, and my other thing about Carrie Fisher is I thought she did an okay job. The part that was hard for me, and there's just, I mean, there's no CGI-ing around this. She's had a lot of work done.
Well,
and it's not doing her a lot of favors as an actor, well, the same as any other
it
actor.
It doesn't, yeah. It doesn't do anybody a lot of favors as an actor. But, you know, again, she's been sort of out of show business. So, you know, I mean, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it was obvious. There was clearly, you know, some augmentation. But it seems like everybody's got it, including half the men, you know.
I
mean,
I know.
Look at freaking Robert Redford fucking had plastic surgery. So, yeah, I can't fault her too much. I actually did feel that at some point there was actual digital augmentation to her, some of her close-ups.
I think there might have been, yeah.
And it was hard to tell, but, I mean, at like a couple of points, I'm like, is this, like, digitally tweaked a little bit? But, you know, God bless her. She's an older woman. I mean, how old is she, like? You know, almost pushing 70.
I'm not mad at her. And
mad at her for aging, Steve.
No, what I mean is though that the combination of the digital focusing and the plastic surgery just bummed me out a bit. Just a little bit of like, oh, but. You know, as you say, that's life.
Steve, it bums me out, too, every time I look in the mirror, my friend.
Yeah,
it's just
this
aging process is really shitty. Mark Hamill was almost the other side of that, because Mark Hamill, you know, had that horrible car accident right before the shooting of Empire Strikes Back started. So his face was severely messed up in this car wreck. They had to do a lot of surgery on him. And, you know, I think over the years, it's affected his career enormously, because obviously, you know, he hasn't been a big movie star or anything like that since the Star Wars movies, let's face it, you know. And he's really made primarily living as a voiceover artist, you know.
Yeah.
So it was cool to see him in this film, not only because it was cool to see Luke, but it, like, he looked cool. Like, whatever damage has happened to his face over the years, now that he's an older guy, it kind of matches the Luke Skywalker character pretty damn well. I mean, he looks kind of grizzled And I like it. He kind of looks badass.
He's got a great beard too.
A great beard, and I'm sort of looking. The thing I'm looking forward to the most in the next film is how Luke is going to be. Like, what's he going to be actually like? Because that's very, very interesting. Because he was a very kind of sunny, upbeat character. Even when he became a Jedi, he still kind of maintained that sort of very positive thing. But as the plot of the Force Awakens told us, the post-Jedi years have been hard on Luke.
Yeah, one of the things that I was kind of impressed by, and this movie set up, it had some dark, dark things that happened. I mean, we'll get to the Kylo Ren character here in a minute, but, you know, Kylo Ren, for everyone knows this who's seen this, when Han Solo dies, I mean, that's one of the darker things in the entire series.
Yes.
And similarly...
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, well, they have set Luke up to be, like, one of the most haunted characters you can imagine.
Right.
In terms of, like, all right, so... Again, in the world of Star Wars, here is what we now know about Luke Skywalker's life, all right? Lives with his aunt and uncle, told his parents are dead. He grows up, his parents are dead.
Right.
Then later learns, like...
His aunt and uncle are dead, too.
Then his aunt and uncle are slaughtered.
Right.
I mean, literally,
in front of him, yeah.
Yeah, like, he finds their burning corpses.
Well, they were basically his parents, because he never knew any other parents.
Okay. I mean, right there, where... That's a horrifying thing.
Dad, yeah.
Then he finds out, hey, you know what? Actually, your dad's not dead. What he is the greatest serial killer in modern times. You know, like, just, like, the most feared, just slaughters people. Do you remember how you've heard about there used to be Jedi? You know how there's not any anymore? That's because your father slaughtered all of them.
Single-handedly. Just, and the children, too.
Killed them all. Yeah. Okay? Uh-huh. Then, oh, by the way, now that you know he's your father, he also recently slaughtered your new mentor.
Uh-huh.
Killed him. And you find your path in life, and your new teacher tells you the only way to really achieve your path in life is to kill your own father.
You gotta kill him.
You gotta kill your father.
Yeah.
He's like, which you don't want
to
do.
Or your other option is to join your father.
Or to join
and
your
like
father.
Be his, your and father's become, evil little puppet.
Yeah. So somehow... You make it all out of
it. Works. It works out.
It kind of works out where, you know, like, you don't have to kill your father. You get a sense that maybe your father is somewhat redeemed by your actions.
Yeah.
Great. Start a school. Going to start getting this Jedi thing back on track.
This is the post. This is what happens to Luke after Return of the Jedi.
And this is what... And then somehow, you know what happens? Your nephew slaughters all your new pupils.
Yeah, your nephew out of nowhere just fucking goes completely evil and just kills everybody.
And some people online, they're like, well, how come Luke is, like, in seclusion? After all that I just described to you, I mean, seclusion's probably the best option, right?
Oh,
I mean,
my
the
God.
Other choices are suicide or just going on, like, his own homicidal rampage.
Yeah, yeah, he, like, moved to some, like, Ireland-type planet, you know?
I mean, it sounds like Luke Skywalker is like, I need to go someplace where I can't do any more damage. Because anyone associated with me...
Yeah.
There's a 90% chance you're going
to
die.
Well, there's an element of bad blood to him, almost.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, something within him, the same thing that gives them this enormous power, also is incredibly corrupt at its core.
Seems like such a bummer for such a nice guy.
It is, and he is a nice guy. I mean, and you know, you, of course, have to wonder how much emotional depth Luke has, because, you know, like, basically 10 minutes after he found his... dead aunt and uncle, he was laughing it up with Chewbacca and, you know, and goofing around, not even a thought given to his dead
well,
you
Chewbacca's
know, family.
Hilarious, but...
Well, he is, and he's great in this movie. Again, I'll say it again, really the star of the film for me, but that's another story. But yeah, I mean, it's really, the years have been rough on Luke, and I like the way it shows on Mark Hamill's face. You know, I like the way that settles.
And his whole character in this movie, you know, he's talked about a lot. He is the MacGuffin, right?
He is the character. He is the thing that everybody in the film is searching for, essentially.
Yeah. But it's nicely set up, I think, going forward.
Yeah, I thought that was clever. I thought that was clever, and I am actually kind of excited to see what the next film is. And the new characters are also very well cast and very well realized, both in performance and the script end.
Yeah, they did. You know, Rey is clearly, you know, they took the hero character and they made her a woman, which is great. I mean, in general, it's...
Young woman.
Yeah, but it's not just a total... It's not just Luke Skywalker as a woman. What's interesting is they also kind of combined her with... like Han Solo and things.
Sure.
Like she's an engineer. She's scrappy. She's doing things.
Well, Luke's kind of engineery too, but I mean she's a terrific character, and she's, you know, I mean she spends like a good chunk of the movie silent, you know, like in the beginning of the film she doesn't actually utter any lines of dialogue for like almost half an hour, if
yeah.
you remember. And she's an engaging on-screen presence, you know? I mean she's pretty, but she's got charisma too.
Yeah. Yeah, and they do a nice job of setting her up where there's multiple instances where someone thinks they need to come, like, rescue her.
Uh-huh.
And she's already taking care of that.
Right.
Like, she's like,
right.
No, I don't need you.
She is not a damsel in distress by any means. And that's really cool, and it's modern, and it's not... No, we're not saying that there's any unbelievable precedent set by a character of this type, but it's cool to see. There's a casual, like, she's the protagonist, and... The fact that she's female is not that big a deal. You just kind of take it in stride.
Well, I read a really interesting like post online from a guy who's not a critic, he's just a dad of a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that he was so relieved in this movie, because so often in these movies, they kind of set up that the woman is maybe the hero, and then like in the third act, it's revealed that actually the guy was really the latent hero.
Mm-hmm.
And she's there to help the latent hero realize his destiny. And in this movie, you know, the guy writing it was saying he was on his guard for that. Like, he was just waiting for it to be revealed that Finn is actually, you know...
Is the main character.
Yeah, the new Jedi. And they didn't do it.
Like, no, it's, not at all.
They didn't upend you on that?
It was actually a pretty good year for feminist cinema, because between the new Star Wars film and the Mad Max film, you know, you have, like, excellent, beautifully realized female characters who take care of business, who are tough, but who are still women. You know, they're not particularly butchy, even, you know, even with short haircuts and missing limbs and all.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool. It's good to see. I like that. I enjoy it. And it was well done in the Star Wars movie. It's like sometimes good intentions don't work out well.
Correct.
You know, and sometimes these kind of politically correct concepts fall flat. But in this film, not at all. It seemed very organic and very nice and well executed. And I think she's going to be a big star, this Daisy Ridley.
Yeah, things look good for her. I also loved the Finn character. I thought it was the defecting stormtrooper.
That's right.
One of the things I really enjoyed about his character is that he's, off and on, he's like 50-50 a coward, which I kind of enjoy. Well, what I mean is he wasn't just instantly...
Right,
you know,
he didn't suddenly become a swashbuckling hero. He's kind of like afraid of what the hell is going on.
Yeah, and you could argue it's... reminiscent of the Han Solo character from the first couple movies, in that, you know, his primary goal is self-preservation. And then his decency winds up, you know, he gets into situations.
Right.
Where, you know...
He becomes a hero in spite of himself.
You know,
in spite
like,
of his,
you know,
cynicism.
His friendship with Rey makes him get into situations where otherwise he'd be out of there.
Yes, his friendship, and obviously he is completely in love with her.
I mean,
from first sight.
From first sight.
Which, if she is
which
a Jedi...
Which is one of my favorite jokes in the when he's talking to her, like, oh, how's it going? What's your life like? You got a boyfriend? Cute boyfriend? It's great.
Yeah, he does that really well, and he's very good. Like, let me ask you about that character, though. Like, so, you know, so he, Finn, was conscripted into the Stormtroopers very early in his life, right? He must have been a child. He talked about it, right? So he's been raised in this kind of militaristic environment. And everybody in that environment, what's the name of that organization now? It's not the Empire anymore.
The First Order,
right?
Yeah.
So the First Order. And we see these guys, and they're sort of fascistic, and, you know, they kind of resemble the Imperial
clearly connected
Army
to the
was.
Empire. Yeah,
yeah, very...
They don't bluntly explain the differences between the two. We don't get a spreadsheet.
Right. But it'll be explained in further movies, but it's definitely connected.
Yeah,
but I'm
just
saying, everybody is sort of very Nazi in their uniforms, and everybody speaks with a British accent, because, of course, the Nazis spoke with a British accent. As we all know from movies. How come Finn has an American accent? And especially in light of the fact that he's played by an English actor who naturally speaks with a British accent, why did they choose to give him an American accent? It doesn't really make sense.
I mean, you could argue that then if they were going with the good guys are American and the bad guys have British accents, except that doesn't work because Daisy Ridley...
Yeah, she's got a British accent. She grew up in a fucking desert by herself, apparently.
Yeah.
And yet she's got a British accent. But the other kid who was raised by these British people apparently developed an American accent. Minor qualm. He gives a fine performance. Another new character that I enjoyed but was somewhat underused was Oscar Isaac, of course, who plays
I'm interested Poe to see
Dameron.
Like what the long-term plans are.
What's the deal
for
with
him?
That guy?
Yeah, because on the surface it almost seems you feel kind of bummed out for Oscar Isaac.
well, in this movie, he doesn't get much to do, right?
Well, yeah, he doesn't. He gets barely much to do. But that guy's he's one of my favorite kind of newer, like, one of my favorite performers who I didn't know about 5 years ago.
Yes.
Who he seems like just a very talented actor. He's got charisma for days. I've seen him play a variety of roles, and in this one, he's certainly got that kind of cocksure strut about him.
Yeah, yeah. It's good to see him in this kind of swashbuckling. I've never seen him do that.
Unfortunately, he crashes his TIE fighter, and then more or less, disappears.
He's gone for 2/3 of the film. And when you do see him, it's in those shots where he's in the cockpit doing like hee-haw kind of a shit, which they do too much in this film, incidentally. Yeah. They needed to. That's another qualm. They need to cut down on the hee-haw and while in the middle of the dogfight.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the super fan service-y bits where, like, little throwbacks to old... I'm not a fan of that, not just in this movie, but in general. Like, I don't know, it's my own curmudgeon-y thing of, like, just tell me a new story, Like, give me new moments, just let me have a new story. Seeing Han Solo and Chewbacca together, like... That's fine. Like, that's
enough nostalgia for you.
That's the throwback. Yeah. Well, yeah. Like, so I'm pleased when they get to do things. I don't need to have them winkingly say dialogue from an older movie to each other. Because just the presence of them is like, we get that. Now let them do something. Which, I mean, for the most part, they do. This movie was pretty good about that. There's bits of it, but...
Yeah. They kept it to a minimum. I mean, there's... Obviously, and this is something everybody knows in terms of the backstory of the production, basically George Lucas sold the right to Star Wars to Disney. And, Disney is a friggin' multinational giant corporation. So one can only imagine how many cooks were in the kitchen during the conception process for this film. And the fact that it still has some kind of... like its own sort of individualism to it, is an amazing achievement. I mean, they really, really nailed it, but I think it was inevitable that they have to pay some degree of kind of fan lip service.
Yeah.
And I think he found a pretty good balance for it. It wasn't perfect. This is not a perfect film, and we said this right off the bat. But it does work as a film, It does kind of, like all of its imperfect little parts, and some very good parts as well, all fall together for an extremely satisfying experience, I think, for the whole family.
Well, and I've had this before with J.J. Abrams, that people would ask me before this movie came out, what do you think about J.J. Abrams directing Star? Are you excited? What's the deal? And J.J. Abrams has been a victim of one of these things in recent years that this isn't his fault. It's like everybody's a hack or a genius. Nobody's like, oh, that guy's pretty good. Like, you got to be one or the other. Either, movie's absolute shit or it's a masterpiece. And my thing with J.J. Abrams, the director, is that I find him, I think he's a great storyteller, which, frankly, a lot of times I have...
he understands story,
I've got issues with directing of, just pacing and storytelling.
Right.
I don't find him the world's most inventive director.
No.
So when I've seen him direct movies, you have to imagine a lot of it just... what's the script? Because if the script is good, he's not going to fuck it up. Like, he'll...
Right.
And if the script's mediocre, it'll be watchable, but not... You know, he made this movie Super 8. And when that movie came out, he got a lot of press about... And he gets great press. I don't know. Whoever's press agent is should be given a raise.
He's a nice guy.
You know, there was a lot of press about how when that movie came out, there were a lot of sequels, just like every other summer. And they're like, in this summer of sequels, here's a true original. And, I mean, Andre, I know you've seen... Super 8 is, I mean, one of the least original movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't, its thing is it doesn't rip off one specific movie.
No.
It takes pieces from like 8 or 10 movies and
right.
just puts them all together.
Right.
But I mean, I watched
it
that
movie. It rips off about 10 different films. Most of them had some kind of Steven Spielberg involvement.
Correct. And
it's like an homage to Steven Spielberg's entire film
yes.
oeuvre
and
minus
you watch,
Schindler's List. And, or maybe not even.
Yeah, maybe it's in there. It's kind of subtle.
Yeah, subtle, yeah.
But as you watch that movie, it's totally watchable. There's some fine performances. But even in the theater, I'm like, man, there's not an original friggin' thought in this entire
right.
thing. And so this, you know, so here's the deal. New Star Wars comes out, has a script that's perfectly fine. And there are some bits
Lawrence
in
Kasdan?
It. Lawrence Kasdan had some Michael Arndt? Or Lawrence Kasdan isn't the sole writer.
No, not yeah. the sole writer. But you kind of you feel his goodness in the script. Like
yeah.
It's definitely Kasdan-y, and it's cool because
yeah.
he belongs there. You know, he wrote.
Yeah, I mean, he was
Empire,
brought in.
He wrote
yeah.
friggin' Jedi. I yeah. mean, he knows
he
Star Wars.
He was brought in to humanize George Lucas way back when, and he continues to do that. Along with Rey and Finn, and of course BB-8, who was fairly
yeah,
charming.
Sure, yeah.
The other major new character, of course, is Kylo Ren.
Well,
is
yeah,
the villain.
There's a whole like set of bad guys.
Yeah.
Kylo Ren being the main one.
Who I thought really delivered. Adam Driver's an actor I've only ever seen in goofy roles.
Right.
You know,
comedies mostly.
According to magazine
girls.
Articles, he's a good actor, but
right.
Well, not that he was bad in those roles.
No,
I mean,
he was
did what he
good
was,
in them.
Yeah, but. You know, when I first heard that guy was the villain, it's a little like, hey, we're doing Star Wars. Who's the new villain? It's Steve Buscemi. He's going to be menacing. And you're like, okay, well, let's...
That could work. I'm not even sure Steve Buscemi is a good example of that. I mean, Steve Buscemi has played enough kind of darker characters where you think it could work. With Adam Driver, it was just a big unknown, right? A giant question mark. Like, we've only seen him do
or like,
these
maybe
lighter
like Jay
roles.
Bruchel would be a better comparison.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy. All right. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, you were told that uh-huh. he's the,
yes.
you know, like he's going to be the bad guy
yes.
in the next Star Trek film.
Yes.
He might be a little like, huh.
Yes. Yes. But
or Jesse Eisenberg is Lex Luthor. I mean, if there was ever some absurd world where, oh, I'm sorry. Sorry.
That could happen. Yes. I like Adam Driver in the lighter stuff I've seen him in. And when I heard of his casting, you know, I sort of came back to the fact like, okay, I've never seen him like play a dark or evil character. But, you know, on the other hand, he is a former Marine. He's seen combat in real life. He's physically huge and could be intimidating. Why not? You know, let's give him a chance. And he was good.
Well, I actually thought he was fairly horrifying as one of the more effective villains I've seen. And one of the things I think they really tapped into, and I mean, maybe this was intentional, but, you know, kind of incorporating the fact that Adam Driver has a bit of the teenager still in him.
Uh-huh.
The character is a terrifyingly powerful, petulant young person.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, these days, there are school shootings. There are crazy teenagers who get in possession of, like, you know, guys like Columbine back when the prequels came out who go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wonder if just even on a subconscious level that's why I found Kylo Ren so disturbing. That he seemed like, on one hand, he takes his helmet off and you're like, oh, he's just a kid. He's a kid. He's conflicted.
Right. It's
on
almost
other...
shocking when he takes the helmet
yeah.
off, right? Because he starts off and he's this sort of Darth Vader-like figure. And, you know, and then he has like a little meltdown that you're like,
yeah.
what the hell is that?
And they even tie into it where some of the reaction of the other, for, you know, some of the non, I don't know if he's a a Sith or what, you know, he's part of this Ren Knights or something. Ren. Yeah. But, you know, some of the reaction of just the standard First
Not
Order...
Not to be confused with the Knights of Stimpy.
Some of the other First Order soldiers treat him like a petulant teenager. You know, like, there's some eye-rolling about, like...
Totally.
You know, Kylo Ren wants a division to go do something, and the guys are like, ah, oh, who gives a fuck what Kylo Ren wants?
You know? There was a great little moment that I kind of skipped the first time. There's a scene where Kylo Ren has his, like, meltdown that, you know, where he just, like, wrecks a hotel room, basically.
Yeah.
And you see, like, you hear it happening, and they cut to a couple of stormtroopers walking down the hall, and they hear him freaking out, and they just... both turn around and walk in the opposite direction.
Leave that alone,
I mean, that's a great, like, visual bit that would have never happened in a George Lucas-directed film.
Correct.
Never happened.
Yeah.
And it needed that kind of stuff.
It does. You need some levity and... But yeah, the Kylo Ren character... Oh, hold on a second. Train of thought. Okay. Right? Oh. But one of the things we really liked how they approached that character that also helped made him... a good villain to me was a friend and I discussed, he uses the Force like a hammer. Darth Vader's going to cut you with his lightsaber, you know, it's like a 10-second process. Like, you know, there's the, you raise the blade, you turn it on, then you fight. Kylo Ren in like less than a second goes from it's not on to you're cut in half. You know, just boom. And I thought that was effective. You know, like it's just... the fast-acting villain is scary.
Yeah, and I liked him overall. I liked the fact that he's also kind of conflicted and emotionally kind of unstable. You didn't know what he was going to do and where he was going to go. And, of course, you gave away, you know, the biggest, you know, surprise aspect of the film, or one of the bigger surprise. But Kylo Ren is essentially the son of Han Solo
and Princess Leia.
He's their offspring who goes terribly bad as a result, apparently, of his Jedi training by his uncle. And he's obsessed
with following the legacy of his grandfather.
That's right, Darth Vader. Exactly.
While apparently just disowning the idea that before he died, Darth Vader kind of, you know, disavowed.
Yes, yes. It's kind of interesting, man. I mean, it's an interesting thing, and there's the scene where Kylo Ren kills his own father, which is shocking on multiple levels, and was certainly a surprise. I didn't see it coming, although, you know, when it got to the scene, I saw it coming, but overall, it was a surprising development. Well, there's like emotional heft to that stuff, and a lot of that heft comes from Adam Driver's performance and Harrison Ford's performance as well. So I like what Adam Driver was doing in the film a lot, and I want to see more of him.
The prequels, one thing about them that is almost underrated is they're kind of weird in places.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is unlike the huge Disney machinery that those are the largest independent movies ever made. George Lucas, for all I know, didn't really have to answer to anybody about those things.
No.
He did whatever the hell he wanted.
No, and I think he refused to answer to anybody.
One of the few guys in the world who's rich enough to do something on that scale without answering to anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so, you know, the Phantom Menace comes out, and before you even see the movie, just from the posters and stuff, people were like, who's this Darth Maul guy? That guy looks kind of cool. He's got spikes and things. George Lucas is like, oh, you like that character? How about I kill him off right away?
Yeah.
Yep.
But also, the character was not interesting. He was physically intimidating and cool, and he fought cool with his lightsaber, but there was no character to him. What the fuck was his motivation? What was he like? He didn't talk, you know? He was a stunt guy in makeup, you know? And
all of that is true. The only reason I'm bringing it up is just to say that in The Force Awakens, they don't introduce a cool-looking villain and then just instantly kill him. They're smart enough to be like, you know what? We're going to do more with this villain.
Well, they introduced even other characters like the Donald Gleason character, who's way playing against type, playing one of those generals. He seems to be like ripe for some early killing, right? I mean,
he's
like, you know, like Peter Cushing's character in the first Star Wars movie. you know, gets killed at the end.
Yeah, and Empire Strikes Back comically goes through just a series of generals.
Oh, he kills a whole bunch of generals, you know. But in this one, they keep him alive. Let him develop a little bit. I like that, too, you know. It's so funny that you mentioned, like, the prequels being probably the world's most expensive independent films. Because, you know, it's interesting how little actual personality those prequels have. And how this giant corporate product that The Force Awakens is, it has more individualism and more kind of a plucky, you know, filmmaking spirit than all of those prequels combined. I mean, and that's a huge thing for that movie.
And so all of that really does have to be laid at the feet of George Lucas. By any measure, he's one of the most successful storytellers in the history of humans.
Yes.
You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, clearly.
And that said, he also seems to be like a rather cold person who doesn't have a firm grasp of what humans are like. But
I think it's just ability at this point, and I think his ability as a director is not where his strength is. And and unfortunately, because he is so powerful, you know, in his own world, at least in the world of Star Wars before he sold it, you know, there was just nobody to counter him. And you know, film is a collaborative process, and sometimes it helps to have a strong person at the top, you know, and sometimes it doesn't. And I think with Lucas, it didn't. I think his abilities as a straight-up filmmaker and storyteller got a little bit rusty with the prequels, and it was obvious, you know. And the prequels did get better as he went along, but man, he just got caught up in a lot of nonsense, you know, like stuff that was interesting to him about Star Wars. I don't think it's what people actually like Star Wars for.
Yeah, like, you know, on one hand, you can sit around and pick these movies apart about how the world all fits together. But, you know, the minutiae of, like, the Star Wars world's politics, that's not why people want, you know?
I don't
like,
think
that's
so.
Not...
Yeah, I'm with you. Some people, I mean, it may be interesting on some levels, but that's not what Star Wars is about. Star Wars is, because it is mythology as opposed to science fiction, and I think that's what George Lucas forgot. I mean, he made the first three films to be kind of science fiction, but also with a strong, like, political bend. You know, he was very interested in how the Republic turned into an empire, which is not uninteresting, but he certainly made it as uninteresting as possible.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the end, it is, you know, it's our connection to the development of these characters and how they handle adversity and this notion of redeeming your parents' generation for the wrong that they have done. And The Force Awakens seems to be aware of it, aware of that, which is most important in Star Wars, and they do a variation on that. And I think the criticism of the film, like the biggest criticism you can make against The Force Awakens, is how derivative it is in some plot points to,
sure,
especially A New Hope, you know, the original Star Wars movie. And that's true. I mean, that's viable criticism. The movie is almost beat by beat repeats what the original Star Wars did. You know?
Correct.
But it works.
Yeah.
It works. It's effective. And, what can you say? Definitely an event film. Did you see it in 3D?
I did not. Did you?
No.
Yeah.
No, I hate 3D.
I'm with you on that. I'm also interested going forward that, you know, J.J. Abrams made a Star Trek movie. I think we both really liked it.
The
right?
first one,
you're,
sure.
You're more well-versed in the Star Trek
I love
world
Star Trek,
than
yes.
I am. You know, one of the things I know a lot of Trekkies liked about it is that they found a way to kind of separate itself from the old Star Trek mythology.
Right.
Like, to make it its own thing.
Sure.
But then, of course, in the second Star Trek movie he did, they went running right back towards it.
Yeah. And
well,
that was a huge blunder.
J.J. Abrams is not going to direct the next movie, so How much he was or wasn't to blame for that, maybe I'm glad that he's not going to be around.
Well, that was a screenwriting decision. And Star Trek, again, is a huge property that doesn't belong to J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hands in it, and there was a screenplay, and decisions were made that were frankly just missteps. And they could have been very easily fixed, and the movie would be regarded much higher than it is right now if they just decided not to do certain things that was blatantly designed to sort of placate the fandom. And it was done badly, and it did the exact opposite of what they intended to do.
Yeah.
So the fact that they did not fall into those traps in the Star Wars film is a great thing. So, big success, in my opinion.
Just did
very well. And certainly an event movie. I mean, everybody had to see it.
Yeah, they created it. It was a big populist spectacle, which was great. And, going back to the beginning of what we were saying about it, it fairly delivered on that. Like, most people come out of it going like, all right, I knew this was going to be this big deal, get everybody. If you went opening weekend, you might have even stood in line. And you came away fairly satisfied.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a satisfying experience. Moving right along those lines.
We got another movie to talk about.
Yeah, The Hateful Eight is a different kind of event film, right?
Yeah, well, there's another way to make an event movie is if you have a movie that, under normal circumstances might just be any old movie, and then you kind of create some other stuff around the presentation of the movie,
right,
in order to jazz up the overall experience.
But with The Hateful Eight, because it is a Quentin Tarantino movie, Quentin Tarantino is, you can argue that Quentin Tarantino is the biggest kind of marquee director working in Hollywood right now. In other words, people know his name. His name is instantly associated with a bunch of films that some people are very passionately in love with. Every new film that Tarantino makes is, in a sense, kind of an event film because he's both popular and kind of a cult director at the same time.
Yeah, in some ways, that's one of the things that's been interesting in recent years is that, Tarantino, until 5 years ago or so, his biggest success was Pulp Fiction. And Pulp Fiction, it's been around for a long time. Pulp Fiction made over $100 million, which, especially at the time it was released, was kind of a big deal. I mean, it's nowhere near Star Wars money or anything like
that.
No. But still,
it's a small budget film.
It's legit. It was a hit movie.
Right.
A hit movie. For the longest time, everything he did after that didn't make anywhere near that kind of money, So he was much more of a cult director, where people knew his name. There's certainly a fan base.
Right.
Would go see him. But, Kill Bill and Jackie Brown and those things didn't make anywhere near money.
They were successful in relation to their production budget.
They were
because
fine,
that's how you count it. If you invest $1, you make $100.
If you were calling him like a director of hit movies, that was fudging the truth a bit.
No.
Until, and this is one of those things, proves, I know nothing, Inglourious Basterds and Django Unchained, those movies were hits.
They were hits, and they're harsh subjects, One is sort of a World War II era film that deals, kind of frankly with the Holocaust and graphically, frankly.
Yeah.
And Django deals extremely graphically with slavery.
Yeah.
And, Bastards is a much better film than Django, I thought, but both of these films really found an audience, apparently, all over the world, extremely successful.
Yeah, so here he is, Tarantino now. Not only does he have still kind of the lingering indie cachet of the 90s, mm-hmm. but he directs hit movies.
He sure does, and I think that's where the problem starts, Steve, because now Tarantino really thinks he can literally do no wrong. I think Tarantino's sort of at a stage in his career where he thinks that every move he makes is kind of a move of genius. And I have to say that I think, that kind of is the reason that The Hateful Eight is, frankly, one of his weakest films.
Yeah, so almost backpedaling a little bit. So The Hateful Eight, there's two ways you can see it. Depending on where you live in the country, maybe only one. There's a version of the movie that is a little under 3 hours. And then there's what they call the 70mm Roadshow version.
Correct.
Which is over 3 hours. Part of that time includes there's an overture at the beginning of the film. Uh-huh. It's about almost 4 minutes long, where the lights slowly dimmed as the music
played. No previews, which was great.
No previews. There's an intermission.
Pee break. Much needed.
And Tarantino, you know, he shot this film in a... ultra panets?
It's ultra Panavision format. It's actually 65mm
lenses,
is what he shot.
Yeah.
No, a 65mm film. Okay.
Oh, film, yes, of
course.
So
it's a big film gauge, twice what 35mm is. So it's rare enough that people are shooting on film at all these days. Most stuff is shot digitally, and probably with very good reason. I mean, digital looks fantastic now.
Yes.
It's almost no trade-off, but film certainly has a magical quality to it, and these larger formats are fantastic looking.
Yeah,
and this film is fantastic.
It is. It's also in a joke that everyone except maybe Tarantino got, is that he, of course, decided to revive this ultra-widescreen film for a movie that takes place mostly in one room.
True.
Which, as far as I can tell, he doesn't... That wasn't dubbed subversively? Like, I don't actually think he thinks humorous.
I don't know how, like, whether he sees the irony in using a huge format like that. Also, you know, using anamorphic lenses, not to get too technical on the cinematography side of things. But you know, he's using anamorphic lenses, and he generally sticks to very wide lenses. What anamorphic lenses do is they essentially, they allow you to film this huge, wide spectrum of vision, but the way the lens works is that it compresses the image, so it's like essentially stretches things up vertically in order to get the stuff onto the film, and then when you print it, you stretch it back out. When you print it for exhibition, now you take that and you stretch it back out to the way it's supposed to normally look. Essentially, it really underlines, you know, landscapes and just width of a lens, you know, so it essentially gives you like the widest lens you could possibly
have. Yeah, and he does, you know, the movie does take place largely in one room, but there are some nice, like, establishing shots where you really get...
Well, it's beautiful, yeah. It's a beautiful vista, you know, it's supposed to take place in Wyoming, but it was shot in Utah, I believe. It's gorgeous. I mean, gorgeous. The film opens, you know, with exteriors and a stagecoach.
Yes.
It's a winter setting. It's beautiful. I mean, visually, it's hard to fault the film. Bob Richardson, who shot it, is
it was great.
Genius.
And, you and I both saw the 70mm version.
Right.
I haven't, like, side-by-sided the two. You know, in terms of the image, I mean, it looked fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure that the 2K version also looked great, because you're talking about, you know, you get the best cinematographers in the world with $1 million budgets.
Yeah.
Movies look fantastic. I mean, Bob Richardson's won multiple Oscars.
Yeah.
He's a pro. His movies look great.
Yeah, his movies always look great. I will actually argue that I'm not sure if he was the right choice of cinematographer for this particular film. I think his stuff just looks too slick for this particular subject matter. This movie needed to be more raw visually, and Bob Richardson makes stuff look too pretty.
He also has this thing. He's one of those guys who he has a gimmick that he will apply no matter what.
No matter what.
And his gimmick is that he likes to flood windows with light. But there are scenes in this movie where, you know, there's no way that the light flooding the window could be justified by anything other than an electrical bulb.
Yeah, it's absurd. I mean, you get, that's one of his gimmicks, and his huge gimmicks is top lights. He loves top lights.
Yeah, he does.
So when you see a movie, you know, Bob Richardson also, like, as a frame of reference, shot a lot of Oliver Stone's films, like The Doors.
And
you just turn
Scorsese
it on.
Some Scorsese, too.
Some Scorsese stuff. I mean, you turn it on and you instantly see these gigantic top lights. People are just, hair is glowing and it's crazy. And, you know, once they, in The Hateful Eight, when they get into this trading outpost in the middle of Wyoming, and you know, a lot of these low angle shots, you see the ceiling and it's a wooden ceiling. There's no light coming through. And then they cut to characters that are top-lit as though the sun is blasting them on top of their head. It doesn't, it's not rationalized by any reality. You know, it's not justified lighting. But it looks good, you know. But
yeah.
Again, is it appropriate for the subject matter? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, and the whole presentation is interesting because, you know, Tarantino, and we'll get some more into this, is, you know, one of the most self-obsessed filmmakers. Like, you know, the guy's been giving 25 years of interviews now where he will tell anybody who asks what a fucking genius he is and how great he is.
Yeah, I mean, he seems self-deprecating to a point, you know, but yeah,
where I'm going with all this is, like, the cynical side of this is that all of this 70mm presentation with the overture, blah, 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 is, you know, Tarantino really thinks his film is some masterpiece deserving of all this. Now, the flip side of that, which is closer to my experience of the film, is that it's kind of a mediocre film, that all of this really made a mediocre film more enjoyable. Like, I went to the 70mm thing again, like, you know, I bought my tickets in advance, I get a little program when I walk in.
Yes, looks great, by the way.
Yeah, and it felt like an event.
It's called like an old school experience. Yeah. Although the whole 70mm thing, I don't know if you forgot this, but, you know, just a few years, Paul Thomas Anderson shot the master in 70mm or Panavision Super 65, and you know, that also looked fantastic. But that was, as a film, it was a better film.
Yes.
You know, so when people talked about it, they didn't talk specifically about the 70mm aspect of it. They talked about how good the film was. You
also
know?
Because that movie, even, you know, we say The Hateful Eight takes place in one room, but there are some nice, you know, exteriors.
Right.
The Master is a movie that, you know, in my memory of it, 60% of it is just extreme close-ups. So, you know, that's 65mm of Joaquin Phoenix and Philip Seymour Hoffman's faces.
Yes. But they're great faces, man, so...
Yeah. I watched that movie, Andre, and I'm watching it, and I'm having a fantastic night out.
Absolutely.
Like, a great time. I'm enjoying it, I'm like, you know, if I was at home watching this on my TV, I don't know if I'd have as good a time.
I don't know that either. And again, I'm going to qualify that a little bit more as well, because I am enjoying it, and after the intermission, so the second half of the film, and even more specifically, the last third of the film, things go kind of bad, Steve.
Yeah.
It does not hold up, and all of the shortcomings of the film really kind of come to a head. And maybe we should back up and talk a little bit about the plot of the movie, and then that'll sort of help us deal with it a little bit. But the plot of the film is fairly simple. You have a bounty hunter that's played by Kurt Russell, who is bringing in a prisoner to Red Rock, essentially to be executed, or to bring in a prisoner to trial. And the whole thing with Kurt Russell's character, whose name is John Ruth, is that he brings his prisoners in alive. They call him the hangman for that.
Yeah, because he likes to deliver them to the hangman.
That's right. He doesn't just like to kill them and bring their bodies in for a reward. He wants to be there and watch them hang, whatever that says about that particular character. Well, along the way, he picks up essentially a hitchhiker who is another bounty hunter who he's met before. This guy played by Samuel Jackson. And this guy's theory is that he brings his prisoners in dead every single time.
Yeah, that the ransoms say dead or alive, and he's like, well, if I kill them, then they can't fight me.
Yeah, well, they're traveling in basically a blizzard, and along the way they pick up another character who happens to be the new sheriff of Red Rock.
So he claims.
Although, I believe him, right? I mean,
by the end, I did. You know, I have to say, for the first third of the movie, I thought maybe that was bullshit.
Well,
but it was.
They set it up to be, like, less than believable, but he's played by Walton Goggins, of course, from the excellent Justified show, and he delivers a very broad performance in a Tarantino sort of way. Anyway, long story short, they end up snowed in at this trading outpost with a bunch of other characters. Essentially, they're trying to figure out who is not who they say they are.
Yeah, it's a classic thing of, like, somebody's lying.
Somebody is there to break out John Root's prisoner, who's beautifully played by Jennifer Jason Leigh, who I'm a big fan of, going back to Fast Times at Ridgemont High. She's helped me along with my puberty to a certain extent, so I have feelings for her. And she's excellent in the film. And everybody's excellent in the film. The film is just chock full of wonderful, you know, quirky, entertaining performances, great line readings, some good dialogue. And yet it doesn't quite work.
Yeah. Steve. Well, Tarantino's always been a guy, you know, who he is the biggest fan of his own writing.
Oh, my God, is he a fan.
And this one is, you know, it is extremely leisurely paced.
Oh, Jesus.
That if I told you, you know, there's a movie, like, okay, well, here's the setup. There's a bunch of characters wind up in this saloon in a blizzard. And, you know, somebody's not who they seem, and they have to figure it out. You say, great, that's an okay premise for a movie. I mean, it takes 40 minutes just to get to the saloon.
And then another 40 minutes to lay out the basic premise of what's happening, you know?
Yeah.
It's just the whole thing. It's like a sort of a mishmash of a Agatha Christie mystery and, like, maybe John Carpenter's The Thing, you know, underlined by Kurt Russell with besplendent facial hair.
Yeah.
And that's okay to put those two things together, but to make a over 3-hour epic out of it, and I also have to say the resolution, the way the mystery resolves itself, is so simple that you're sort of, like, I was rolling my eyes going, like, we needed fucking 3 hours for this shit?
No.
Three hours to get to this? I really enjoy the first half of the film. Then it gets to the not 100% on the first half, but really enjoyed it. Then the intermission comes along, and things get kind of weird. One of the things that gets weird just structurally is all of a sudden, Quentin Tarantino himself starts completely arbitrarily narrating parts of the action.
Yeah.
Now, on top of the fact that this is, again, Tarantino using the chapterized gimmick. Now, he's used that in virtually every film.
Yeah, he likes to
He likes to chapterize stuff. I get it. I'm tired of it. I'm genuinely tired of the chapters, dude. I want him just to tell a story from beginning to end without the cue chapters. But if you're already using the chapters, do you really need to kick in with a voiceover narration? I mean, is that necessary at that point? And it was some of the most pointless narration I've ever heard in any movie. Like, the entire narration segment was designed to sell a joke, essentially a visual joke, in my opinion. Okay, I don't know if you agree with me on this or not, but that's how I feel. Like, I heard, at the end of the narration, I sort of thought to myself, like, it was all done to sell this one fucking joke, and the joke wasn't that funny.
Yeah.
So what was the point? Why? I don't, like...
Well, it also seemed like it was, you know, I'm sure he'd never copped at this, but it's like he had this whole movie, and then he has this only one section with narration, which right away is a red flag. That, I mean, like, to me, either your movie has narration or it doesn't.
Right.
To only have it in one scene just feels like, clearly, you know, you fucked something up in either the writing or the filmmaking.
Well, or something was adjusted, you
know? Yeah, but that could only be clarified through someone explaining you.
That was gratuitous narration, Steve. It didn't do anything. He did nothing needed explaining there. Nothing.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, my memory of that narration sequence is he had the need to explain the bit about, you know, Jason Lee's character seeing somebody poison the coffin.
Right. Yeah, I get it.
You could have done that a gazillion ways.
Like,
without...
I mean, he showed it. He literally is. I mean, he wasn't just narrating. He was showing what he was narrating.
Correct.
So it wasn't just a case of, like, show and tell. It was a case of show and tell and then tell some more on top of the showing and telling. So, I mean, it seemed out of place. And then what was essentially up to that point, a movie with no action in it whatsoever, just talking for the most part.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of abuse of Jennifer Jason Leigh. We'll get to that a little bit later.
Yeah.
But so it was an extremely talky movie for half of it. So now we're like into an hour and a half, pushing 2 hours of running time. Intermission comes, the second half starts, and it turns into this kind of gross out, unbelievably violent, even by Tarantino standard, bloodbath that seems to be kind of partially played for laughs.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting there sort of going like, what the hell is going on here? Like, what is this supposed to be? What are the filmmaker's intention for me? What am I supposed to get out of this? And this is a question I never really was able to answer on The Hateful Eight. Like, I could answer that question every single Tarantino movie, and you know I love Tarantino. But in this film, I was at a loss. I'm sitting there going, like, why? What is he trying to say? I don't think he ever said anything particularly concrete or particularly intelligent about anything. I mean, anything. And on top of that, like, how does he want me to participate in this process? Like, does he want me to be grossed out? Does he want me to be kind of gleefully laughing at the violence? Does he want me to be happy when these characters are killed in horrible ways, even though I kind of like them?
Yeah.
What does he want from me? And I still don't get it. I don't understand. Maybe you could clarify it for me. What the fuck is the point?
Well, I was unsure myself. I mean, in the viewing audience I saw, I would have to say that 90% of the movie played like a comedy. And then
everybody,
even the parts
laughing
that weren't obviously a comedy, almost played like an unintentional comedy. There
yes
were parts where you're like, wait a minute, am I supposed to take that at face value? Because that's kind of absurd, especially combined with what's been going on before. And, you know, some of the performances are, like, very broad.
I mean,
that happens
huge,
a lot with, and, you know, not only Walton Goggins, but Tim Roth, who's, I thought he was clearly doing the Christoph Waltz performance, which further was a little silly to me just because I felt that Django Unchained's character was just the exact same character from Inglourious Basterds. I mean, he's become
the
German.
He's the Joe
Pesci of Quentin Tarantino films.
Christoph Waltz was German in that film. Tim Roth is British in this film.
Sure,
that's the difference.
Sure, sure.
You know, I've heard that said before. I actually really enjoyed Tim Roth's performance. And again, it just brings me back to the fact I enjoyed virtually every single performance in the film, including a bunch of throwaway performances that seemed to be tacked on in the second half that went back in time to show what happened before the characters showed up. It was completely gratuitously unnecessary. It was extremely violent and disturbing, and yet still seeming to smirk at the slaughter that was taking place on the screen in front of me. And it seemed like it was out of some other movie. It seemed to not belong in this film. And for a film that's over 3 hours long, to have a fairly significant section that seemed to be completely out of left field seemed like bad idea or bad screenwriting or something, man. I don't know. It rubbed me the wrong way. That section actually rubbed me the wrong way.
Oh, the flashback section?
Well, the flashback to what happened to Minnie and the rest of the people at the outpost. You know?
I know a lot of people were disturbed by it, mainly because the people at the outpost earlier were clearly the most likable people in the film.
Well, sure,
so
yes.
So it's just morally disturbing.
Yeah. Yes.
I actually enjoyed that section just because it had the most legit tension for me, that you knew how it was all going to go bad.
Mm-hmm.
And right. I really liked, again, we're spoiling everything, Channing Tatum, I thought, was very effective in that. But
I agree.
Well, that was part of my problem, though, with the other parts of the film, are that, you know, at first there was some tension, but the length, I felt, really worked against the tension in the movie. That, you know, if you have a bunch of dangerous guys in a room, that's tense. But if you have a bunch of dangerous guys in a room for 2.5 hours, you know, you kind of settle in and it's not quite as menacing anymore.
Absolutely. And, you know, he's done this sort of bunch of dangerous men locked in a room, not trusting one another thing in what was essentially his first film, Reservoir Dogs. And he pulled it off so brilliantly in that film, and it was so well balanced. And there was actual human emotion involved. And, you know, you felt for characters. You didn't want characters to die. This movie seems to be almost a step back in his abilities as a filmmaker, because here he takes a similar situation, a bunch of arguably negative characters. I mean, I don't know if I'd call them hateful, but certainly unpleasant. Locked in a room, looking for something unknown to materialize, And I felt the tension a lot less than it was in Reservoir Dogs. So I'm watching it, I'm comparing it to an earlier film he made, and it's not comparing favorably for me. That's a bit of a problem, man.
This reminded me of my biggest problem with Django, is that both Django and this, you know, it feels almost like they were written in real, not in real time, but completely in order. You know, obviously, mm-hmm. I'm assuming the movie was not shot in order. But both these films feel like they reach a point where they're like, fuck, what do we do? And then they're kind of punting.
Right.
You know, like, Django, I think, is a better movie than this. My problem with Django is that, you know, it's right there in the title. It's supposed to be Django's story.
Right.
And for the first 3/4 of the movie, it's clearly the Christoph Waltz character's story.
Right.
And then the final act feels real tacked on to me.
Oh, my God.
Like, he's just like, it's almost like he finished the film, reread it, and then said, oh, fuck, I didn't make Django the main
Django
character. Yeah, so then he has to let Django have... And I agree, I think the movie should have been Django's story, and it should have concluded with Django getting his revenge. But then what you need to do is, like, rewrite the parts. You know, like, you need to kind of do an overall, and... You know, again, I have no inside information. He probably did do several drafts, but
well,
like watching the film, it felt like he did he made it to the end of the Christoph Waltz story, and then was like, "Should I revise? Nah, just go forward, just tack something else on." And this was similarly that the resolution of this movie felt so much like all this for what?
Yeah.
And I kept searching to find, like, is there some metaphor I'm not seeing?
You know,
like,
is this exactly what I'm saying?
This supposed to be like all the worst parts of America locked in a room together?
It would have been great if it was that.
And yeah, but you know, you.
But it wasn't.
No, you mentally go down that road just like a minute or two, and you're like, yeah, that doesn't.
It wasn't. If it was meant to be that, it did not succeed in being that. And I'll go back to Django for a second. I actually do think that The Hateful Eight is a better, more balanced film than Django. Because Django, if Django did not have that really, really weak tacked on it, last section, and it was stunningly weak. I mean, like, there was a gigantic quality drop-off between Django most of the film and Django the last 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
It was such a massive drop-off in quality that it was frankly shocking. It was almost like all of a sudden it turned into some other movie that really sucked. This movie did not have that level of derailment happening, you know? This movie never went from being, you know, really good to really bad. This movie just kind of stayed a little bit unfocused, better in the first half than the second half, but it was still a little bit more balanced than Django. So if I have to enumerate Tarantino movies down the line, this will probably sit right on top of Django, right on top, a little bit. But I may be wrong. We'll see how it settles. Like, when I try to watch it again down the line, I might enjoy Django more. Who knows?
Django, at least, I felt had some more original things going on for it. And I agree with you that the final
bit... And it was a more serious film, too. It had something to say.
Well, that's what part of... The final bit is weak, but at the same time, it did deliver the audience thrill of Django kicking ass.
Right, right.
Like, you know, that bit.
It did. It just should have... It was just clumsily done. But you know, again, Django had an agenda, and that agenda was to make a Western, or whatever it was. I mean, it wasn't set in the West, but it's essentially a Western, you know. To make a Western set in the pre-Civil War era that honestly deals with the concept of slavery and what slavery is actually like. And he succeeded in showing the brutality of that world. And in this movie, there is no grand idea like that behind it. It's just essentially a glorified mystery that's set in the West, you know? So it feels emptier than Django, you know? It feels like, even though there are themes of racism, I mean, racism is the main kind of theme in the movie, but it's just not developed very well. It's not thought out very well. It's not...
Yeah, he dips in and out of it. Like, Samuel L. Jackson's character has a couple speeches that are, you know, somewhat interesting. But, again, it's just so in and out that it... Well, and it makes it feel more tokenism. Like, he's got, like, oh, if, you know, if I inject just a little bit of politics into it, maybe it'll... permeate through the rest of it. But that's not what happened.
Yeah, and I don't feel it, and I didn't feel it from other people as well, you know, in the theater. Like, I felt, like everybody laughed at the same places I laughed and kind of gasped at the same places I gasped. And at the end, I saw a lot of kind of, like, people looking at each other like, what the fuck did I just see? You know? What the hell was that? What was that about? I enjoyed it, but it, does it have any meaning? Does it have anything to say? And I think ultimately the answer is no. So it's less than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, which is kind of a bummer. So,
it is a bummer.
I know. Also, I'm sitting here listening to us, and it sounds like we're both really shit-canning a movie that we had a great time watching.
I know. I know. And that's it's a problem. But, you know, it's a lot more fun to discuss good movies that are imperfect, you know, or movies that are deeply flawed but have a lot of good things in them, rather than just bad movies that are just bad.
Yeah.
You know, we're not here talking about the Ridiculous Six by Adam Sandler. That's a bad movie.
Uh-huh.
I tried watching it. It's really bad.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we're not talking about that film because that wouldn't be fun. But in the case of Hateful Eight, it is. It's an interesting subject. Well, the other thing I think we wanted to talk a little bit about it that was disturbing to you, maybe a little more than to me, but nonetheless, I think it's worth talking about, is that there's essentially one main female hateful character in the film.
Correct.
And that's Jennifer Jason Leigh, the prisoner. And, you know, throughout the film, she gets the shit beat out of her, particularly by Kurt Russell, but you know, she gets kind of treated badly by everybody in that movie. Yeah.
And we mean shit beat out of her, like, in the literal sense. Like, punched in the face.
Punched in the face. I mean, just physically abused. And it's treated in a way as though, like, in this sort of pseudo-comical way. Like, we're supposed to laugh at it, like, when the Three Stooges, you know, smack each other on top of the head. And, you know, it's kind of weird, man.
Yeah,
it's
there is. I mean, there,
weird.
There's
it's gleeful.
There's somewhat of an
misogyny.
Arc to the violence in that the, you know, the first time she gets hit in the stagecoach, it is kind of funny in a weird way. But then it keeps going on, and you could argue that maybe that's part of his point, is that, you know, we, like, when does violence stop being funny and start being just brutal? But I don't know if I buy it. I mean, there's a whole. You know, some filmmakers claim that the way to show how women are treated unfairly in society is they make a film where a woman just gets shit on, metaphorically or otherwise, for, like, the whole film. Lars von Trier's made, like, half his movies are about this. And I just don't know if I buy that that is the most effective way to show, like, you know, to protest the treatment of women. It's like,
yeah,
everybody shits on women. Here, let me show you a woman just getting shit on.
Well, I don't think that was even his point in this, you know?
I don't either.
I think he had zero about that.
Yeah.
You know, that's not what this movie's about. But yet, you're right. It's happening continuously throughout the film. You know, you kind of find yourself laughing about it. But at the same time, you got to ask, like, what the hell am I laughing about? And, and it's just weird, man. I don't know.
Tarantino's always had a gleefulness to his violence, which I understand.
Yeah.
And depending on your level of tolerance, you know, you could argue none of it's ever necessary. But this movie really did just feel that a lot of the treatment of her did kind of go above and beyond.
Yeah.
You know, that there was stuff that...
There was a gratuitous element to treatment of her.
Specifically her. Like, the other characters...
Right. Like, everybody is an asshole in the film, but not everybody gets their front teeth knocked out.
Yeah.
For a laugh.
Yeah.
You know? And that's a little bit strange, man. And I'm not... actually, you know, I think there is a theory that... And you mentioned this, kind of touched upon it just now, but that if you show characters sort of getting equal treatment, whether it's good or bad, you are in fact treating them equally. But I didn't feel that was happening in this case. She was within the process of the film. They never revealed what her crimes were, why she was supposed to be so evil. We were supposed to see that she's evil by the evil faces she was making, essentially.
Yeah.
But what does that really mean? And at the end, they never really said what it is she did that was so fucking bad. Essentially, they said she was part of a family gang, like the James Brothers. I mean, in other words, there was nothing that character did to justify being abused for the whole film. And when you think about it, it didn't particularly bother me when I was watching it. I was more bothered by the structural elements of the movie. But now that we're discussing it, it actually bothers me a little bit.
Yeah, it was a hard, and you know, I think I would have been a little unnerved if they were beating the shit out of a male prisoner, but you can't deny that the only real female character in the film, there's an added element to it that's uncomfortable.
Yeah, uncomfortable, but not done with a particular purpose.
Not with a point, yeah.
And so, that's another thing. If there's no purpose, from the director, then a lot of stuff comes off looking haphazard. And if it's violence of that sort, then it's kind of negative, man. It's kind of negative. But, you know, if you get a chance to see The Hateful Eight in its 70mm,
I definitely recommend the 70mm version, because at least you'll have like a fun experience out of it.
I don't know how long that's going to be around, by the
way. That's true. And I don't know if I recommend The Hateful Eight as a couch viewing experience.
Yeah, as a rental. Well, you know, at least you could watch it on three separate nights and still, and you don't have to deal with a whole 3-hour thing on the couch. But
And intermissions whenever you want.
Exactly. Well, that's all I got on these films, Steve. Kind of unusual for us to review current movies. I think we need to go back and talk about Charlie Chaplin or something like that.
Yeah, we'll see what we do next time.
All right, man. Well, that's all for us. I'm Andre Shane.
I'm Steve Askin.
This is Film Driven. There's a star.